This is the Past Lives Podcast, episode 180. I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Past Lives Podcast is to investigate evidence that demonstrates survival of the human soul. We look at past life memories, near-death experiences, spirit communication, and other incredible phenomena. Now, this is the free one-hour version of the episode. The extended episode is an hour and 20 minutes, and to get access to the extra 20 minutes and other extended versions of the episodes, you can join the Past Lives Podcast Patreon campaign. When you sign up for $5 a month, you get an extended episode every week, and for $2 a month, you get an extended episode every month. The Patreon campaign has changed so that the previous bonus episodes have been removed and the extended episodes remain. This means that including this episode, there are now 24 extended episodes for the $5 patrons. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/pastlivespodcast or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. Also, when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me and you're a patron, you get a 25% discount. And I'm offering a free consultation call which can be booked on my website. The links are in the show notes, and you can find the show notes for this and every other episode on my website. My Instagram is the Past Lives Podcast with an underscore between each word, and on Twitter I am at Simon G. Bowne. This week I'm talking to Helen A. Warbear about her book, The Science of Channeling, Why You Should Trust Your Intuition and Embrace the Force That Connects Us All. Helen A. is the Director of Research at the Institute of Noetic Sciences and an Adjunct Assistant Professor in the Department of Neurology at Oregon Health and Science University. She's completed 2 postdoctoral research fellowships. She is author of more than 90 peer-reviewed publications. She has published on and spoken internationally about her studies on complementary and alternative medicine, mind-body medicine, extended human capacities, stress, post-traumatic stress disorder, and their relationships to physiology, health, and healing. Hi, Helene. Thanks for coming onto the podcast. It's really kind of you to give us your time.
It's such a pleasure to be here with you today.
I was reading your book, The Science of Channeling. That's why I wanted you to come onto the podcast. It's so fascinating. And like I was saying before we started recording, I got so many questions, and it's only from the first 3 or 4 chapters. To start off, you've written this book about channeling, but it's not like you're, say, just a researcher. You've been doing this your whole life.
I have. I've actually had channeling experiences from a very young age, like many other people who first experience these phenomena when they're children. So as a child, I had experiences that, you know, being very sensitive in rooms or feeling people's emotions, seeing things that maybe other people didn't quite see. And I just felt like they were a normal part of who I was. So I didn't really mention it to anybody. And as I grew older, I got exposed to what you might call trans channeling at a seance, or what my family called meetings. When I was 10 years old, my mother took me to my first meeting, and there were about 30 people sitting around a room, and my uncle was trans channeling. My grandmother is a trans channel. My mother has since learned how to trans channel, and I actually learned how to do it in the last couple years. And channeling was just such a big part of my personal life. I didn't really talk about it with anybody. It was just kind of this unique thing that my family did. And I experienced it in a very isolated way compared to the rest of my community in the outside world. So I'm really excited now that I'm able to, you know, bring this personal experience and to be able to study it in a rigorous way with scientific methods.
And when you first went to that first channeling meeting and you saw what was happening, did it kind of freak you out? Or did you feel like, hey, yeah, I know what this is. I almost do this myself.
Well, I hadn't experienced trans channeling before. And my mother, I know she was doing the best she could, but she didn't really give me any context or explanation of what I was going to see. It was like, hey, we're going to Tata and Sido, which is what my grandparents were called. We're going to their house for a meeting. And we show up and I'm witnessing this, and it scared me. I was definitely afraid, and I was wondering if, you know, they believed that a spirit was communicating through my uncle, right? So I was like, okay, is a spirit going to jump in me without me giving permission? You know, is this going to happen to me? And there was definitely a bit of fear about it. What was clear to me, just knowing my uncle so well, is that it wasn't him. Like, I couldn't imagine. He was so very different in when he was doing the trans channeling, and different voice, different mannerisms, different vocabulary. You know, at the time he was just a high school graduate, didn't really have a refined, extensive vocabulary. And the things he was saying was so outside of his normal way of being. So I didn't think he was faking it or anything. I didn't have the perception that it was fake, but there was a little bit of fear that it would happen to me without me giving permission for it to happen.
And could he speak languages that he didn't know?
My uncle never did that, but I had heard that my grandmother had. I never witnessed her doing it. But we do know of lots of cases in the parapsychology literature of channelers doing that, of actually speaking languages that they couldn't have possibly known in any other way.
And when they're doing this trance channeling, do they also do automatic writing?
My uncle did automatic writing. My grandmother did not. My mother does. And of course, for the listeners, the automatic writing is a type of trans channeling, if you will, but it's not the body voice being used, but the actual hand. So the belief is that a non-physical being is using the body through the hand to write out a message. And, you know, there's channeled writings through automatic writing. I mean, volumes and volumes and volumes. We could fill I don't know how many story building with all the material that has been supposedly brought through in that way. So my uncle actually wrote a book using automatic writing called From a Gun to a Flower during this intense trans channeling period in the 80s.
And is it kind of a real spiritual book, or is it a novel?
It's a deeply spiritual book. And the guidance that was given to them at the time was to publish it as is. And no publisher was willing to do that. So they ended up self-publishing it, because there was what was unique about my uncle's channeling is that it came through in a specific cadence, and everything rhymed. And so the messages were were in a very specific, unique way that wasn't normal conversational speaking. All the messages were rhymed and had a specific cadence to the rhythm of each sentence. And so they didn't want to edit that. They wanted the message to come through in that pure way. So my grandfather embarked on self-publishing it before, you know, you could jump on Amazon and self-publish your book in an afternoon. And it was an interesting process for my family to go through that.
Is it available on Amazon now, or is it you just have some physical copies?
Great question. I believe it is available on the From the Gun to a Flower website, and I can get you the link to that. And we do have still a bunch of physical copies as well.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, that'd be brilliant. So this thing with trance channeling, and it seems like the person steps to one side and allows a spirit to come in and communicate. Am I getting it right? Because it sounds like what some people say is physical mediumship. Is it kind of like the same thing?
That's right. And, you know, my biggest challenge in starting to work in this field was the terminology, because there's so many different terms that are often referring to the same thing, or the same word meaning different things. So you just mentioned physical mediumship, trance channeling, possession, automatic writing. These are all referring to, you know, similar aspects of the broader term of channeling. If you say mediumship to someone, they might have, you know, four or five different definitions for what they mean by mediumship. So the terminology can sometimes get us into trouble. So yes, trance channeling, physical mediumship, often refers to this experience that the channeler describes as their body being used as a vehicle for some sort of discarnate, non-physical being to communicate through them. So in the past, you may have heard of trance channelers who were actually completely asleep. So they have no awareness of what is happening to them when they're in these trance channeling states. I think Ramtha, and I'm blanking on the channeler's name, John of God is like this. There's a few other modern day channelers who have this very, very deep trance where they actually don't know what's going on for them. And when they're done, you know, they have to explain to them what happened while they were in the trance state. Most trance channelers today don't go into such a deep state. They have some level of awareness and are often they describe it as stepping aside and observing what is happening. And, you know, they may not have any clue what they're going to say next. Their mouth just is moving and words are coming out, but they have no sense of what's going to be said. It's quite a fascinating experience. I saw my relatives doing it my whole life. And when I started getting into channeling research and wanted to study trance channels, I was really curious about what it felt like. And so I learned from a colleague of mine that you could actually learn how to trance channel, and they developed this hypnosis protocol to teach people how to trance channel. And because it ran in my family, I said, well, I could learn how to do it. So I embarked on this process to learn how to trance channel. That was a couple years ago, and have since done so and can do so if I choose to. And it is the most incredibly bizarre experience I've probably ever had, where you just start talking, but I don't know what's going to come out of my mouth. It's quite incredible. So the book, The Science of Channeling, is not just about trans channeling. It's about channeling in general. So I use this really broad umbrella term to define channeling, which is essentially this process of accessing information and energy not limited by our conventional notions of time and space, and that it can show up in a receptive way, like claircognizance, clairvoyance, clairaudience, or it can show up in an expressive way, like, you know, psychokinesis or mind over matter, and that the way channeling shows up for people is quite unique to them and very diverse. There are so many different ways that people can access this information and energy. And so the whole book is about describing those various ways, the various research studies that have been done on each of them, verifying them in the laboratory, and how to perhaps nurture those channeling experiences in people who choose to.
Because you say it comes in different ways for different people. You talked about how your uncle helped you with back pain after a riding accident. So that's something completely different to trance channeling, isn't it?
Well, again, it's this whole terminology, right? So people might call that energy healing. But some energy healers might say that they trance channel, that when they're in a trance channeling state, that they can impart healing to other people. So in that moment, was my uncle in a channeling state? I would say absolutely. And I don't think it was his ego personality body that was manifesting that healing in me. And just to give a little background for the listeners, I was in a horseback riding accident, and I had gotten thrown and hit the ground pretty hard, and wasn't able to walk. And I was in excruciating pain. And so I think my uncle had his hands on my lower back for maybe 20 minutes, half an hour. And the pain was totally gone, and I was able to walk with ease after that. And that story is not an isolated incident in the world. I mean, there's so many anecdotes and also formal studies now looking at energy healing and people being able to impart healing on people, especially around pain, cancer, mental health symptoms. There's growing evidence that energy healing is a verifiable phenomenon. And so I would consider healing as one type of channeling phenomenon.
Earlier in your life, you were working with patients, you're working with veterans. Were you able to see some kind of, I don't know, is it an energetic overlay, and you could see where the problems were?
Yes. So one of my research studies in academia, I had a study funded by the National Institute of Health, and we were looking at mindfulness meditation and if it could support combat veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder, if it could improve their symptoms, and also to learn how mindfulness meditation worked. We did EEG, brainwave collection, heart waves. We did all these physiological measures and also collected subjective measures. So I was the principal investigator of that study, and one of the jobs in the study was for me as a clinician to do their diagnostic intake to confirm that they actually had post-traumatic stress disorder so they could be in the study. So this was, you know, I would spend a couple hours with them, and they were basically telling me their story of their trauma. So I didn't anticipate that this would happen, but often when they were telling me their story of what happened, let's say in Vietnam, about how they had this traumatic incident with one of the locals who died, and I might see a being show up in the rooms, you know, some sort of visual of this being, and see a connection of guilt and pain and suffering around this incident in the veteran. And of course, I never mentioned that to them. I never shared that at my lab meetings. I couldn't verify what that visual was that I saw, if it really was a being or some sort of telepathic projection or who knows, or some sort of, you know, imagination on my part. And yet that was my subjective experience during a lot of those interviews, was being able to see pieces of their story showing up around them.
And did you also mention there might have been a past life situation that was related to their health?
Sometimes I can't remember that exactly with veterans, but that did show up when in my clinical practice, when I would see patients. And, you know, I might see, you know, one time I saw like a rope around someone's neck, and they were having a lot of neck pain. And the impression was perhaps in a previous life, they may have passed by hanging. Again, I can't verify if that was actually real or not. And yet when we, through, you know, the counseling aspect of my practice, supported them around, you know, fear of dying in a traumatic way and working through massage and other things to support their neck, then the pain goes away. It's quite fascinating. And also using things like flower essences and homeopathy and other alternative energetic medicines to support the person.
Yeah, okay. So it's kind of like there's a whole toolkit of different things that are used to bring about this positive outcome. But you were talking about verification there, and it reminded me that you did a channeling session with your grandmother and that you'd had a conversation before that that she could not have known about and that it came through.
Yeah, that was pretty wild. I had a conversation with my grandmother alone on her deathbed, and it wasn't right before she passed, but pretty close. And she was sharing about how while she loved my grandfather dearly, she wasn't that excited about spending eternity with him. And one of the reasons she wasn't quite ready to leave her body yet was because she was worried that she was going to be married for the rest of eternity. And that was her, you know, Christian upbringing understanding. And so, you know, I didn't mention that to anybody. And it was a private conversation. And, you know, my mother, after my grandmother passed, my mother and I did a channeling session. And we believed my grandmother was coming through and speaking to us. And she said to me, you know, I'm not still with your grandfather. We're kind of doing our own things. I don't remember her exact words, but it was quite fascinating for her to mention that and knowing that, you know, we had that conversation. So, you know, what's funny in parapsychology is that there's this huge debate about information like that and where it's coming from. So is it really my grandmother who's a separate personality that has survived her bodily, physical bodily death and is somehow through some mechanism we don't understand communicating through my mother? Or is there some telepathic connection that I'm tapping into or that my mother is tapping into and that she's communicating? Is there some, perhaps there's some field that holds all information of all time, like the Akashic records, etc., and that's being tapped into? Or maybe the fact that I'm sharing this to you now, in the future, there's some precognitive loop that information is then known that my mom picked up on during her channeling. So we could really twist ourselves into knots trying to understand how to verify this information. In the moment, I can take off my scientist hat and be the person in the moment. In the moment, sitting across from my mother who has no motivation to fake this stuff, it energetically felt like my grandmother and her sharing that was really amazing and inspiring and comforting to me as a person.
Yeah, that's one of the things I think that, you know, you can have some amazing experience and you might talk to somebody you know about it who might be quite skeptical and they can find reasons why it might not be real. But the thing is that for you, when you experienced it, it was really quite powerful, and that's not something you can put across in just a conversation.
Absolutely. There's a lot of people in the parapsychology field who, you know, hold that premise that it's like, okay, let's stop focusing on proving whether it's real or not or how to verify it. Let's see if it can be useful in any way. And that's not to say we aren't curious about the source and verifying, but that right now, with the tools we currently have, we may not be able to definitively know, right? So what can we know? There's some great work being done around grief therapy and how mediumistic readings help people process their grief. You know, that's just a simple example of being like, okay, it doesn't matter if the medium's really talking to the deceased person, how is it actually impacting the clients? And overwhelmingly, they're getting great benefit from it. So in that case, does it really matter who the medium's actually connecting with? Some might argue yes, but I don't think so. I think we can take it at, you know, look at the value that it brings to people's lives and take it for that piece of it.
As I work as a clinical hypnotherapist and I take people through past life regressions, mostly for therapeutic reasons, and that might be one of the things I say to them is that you have these visualizations in your imagination, you'll see these past lives, and you might feel that you're making it up, that it's just your imagination. But if you're getting a positive outcome from it, does it matter if the past life is real? And I think that helps them a bit, because some people do get quite logical and they question it all and they do want to know whether it's a real past life. But being told, actually, does it really matter if it's really helping you? That helps them in another way.
Right. It gives them permission on some level. And there's some incredible stories with past life regressions and phobias being reduced and all these really fantastic anecdotes. I find that work fascinating. Have you seen that in your own practice where someone's phobia has been diminished or gone away?
I've seen all sorts of things. I had a young lady in Russia who had a terrible feeling of guilt. And we went to three past lives in the session, and each one showed her in a situation where she was tremendously guilty. One was, she was an old lady and she was dying in bed, and there was a teenager sitting next to the bed, and she knew that when she died, the parents weren't there and this child would go to an orphanage, and she felt terribly guilty. And then she saw another life where she was a doctor and she rushed to help a woman giving birth. And he realized when the baby was born, it was terribly ill and he couldn't save the child. And he felt terribly guilty. And it was like this guilt was being carried on to her current life. And so we did some energy release stuff with the hypnosis. And she said afterwards, you know, quite bewildered. And she said, I don't know what just happened to me. You know, she was quite confused. But I had a client who had pain in his lower abdomen. And we went to a past life where he was stabbed in his lower abdomen. And I talked to him a couple of weeks later, and he said the pain has greatly reduced and that he keeps poking himself because he can't believe the pain has gone so much. So it's remarkable what's happening there. And it might be all in your subconscious, and it might be that they're not real past lives, but something is definitely happening there that is helping them.
It's quite fascinating. And that reminds me of the reincarnation work done at the University of Virginia, where, you know, you see these children who are born with actually severe birthmarks that are reflective of the past life that they're remembering. You know, so let's say they were, I mean, this is a horrible example, but someone was shot in the head from the right side and there's like a huge indent in the head, or, you know, something about missing a leg and then the leg has a intense deformity. There's so many different cases of that. It's quite fascinating. And, you know, this leads to this whole topic of, you know, who are we really? Like, what is our consciousness? And, you know, how can these things actually be transmitted in this way, whether it's a past life or a reincarnation or who knows what? And, you know, this comes up a lot in my book around this idea of non-local consciousness, and that our consciousness isn't just limited to our physical brain. That's what, you know, the materialistic paradigm tells us, which is the dominant worldview right now in our world, in the West especially, but that there's so much evidence growing that that's not actually true, that there is more than the material. The materialistic worldview can explain a lot of things for us that we perceive and experience, and yet it doesn't explain everything. And that channeling, you know, this idea that a remote viewer can actually perceive a distant location halfway across the world accurately, that's not explainable from materialism. But if you imagine that our consciousness is non-local, meaning that it transcends space and time, then that makes a lot more sense. If we, you know, imagine that our consciousness somehow survives our body's physical death, then past lives and these sort of energetic imprints start to make a little bit more sense, because my consciousness is still holding that guilt and it comes into a new human body, but it's still holding that sort of energetic frequency, if you will, for that guilt. Now, in all of our studies, the channelers always talk about frequency, frequency, energy, energy. And I'm very much looking forward to us being able to develop the tools to actually measure what that is, because I don't know if it's frequency in the way that we understand it, in frequency of life. Is it frequency of light? Is it sound? Is it who knows what? So at IONS, we're really working to try to develop the tools so we can actually tease some of these pieces apart.
Hello, listeners. This is Simon. Now, some of you know I have a diploma in clinical hypnotherapy, and I'm certified in past life regression therapy. And in the past few weeks, I've taken many clients through some amazing and healing past life regressions. And I conduct sessions over Zoom, and I've had clients from many countries around the world. Now, when you go through a past life regression, you will feel totally in control and remember everything. And also, I record the whole session and send you an MP3 afterwards. And this gives you space to relax and go with the flow, knowing that you can listen back later and analyze what you experienced if you need to. So if you ever wanted to explore your past lives in a single session, or have an issue you want to work on, you can go to my website at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk and book a free 20-minute consultation. And at the moment, I'm offering a 25% discount to everyone that has signed up to the Patreon campaign. The link is in the show notes. So can you tell us what is the Institute of Noetic Sciences? What does noetic mean?
Noetic comes from a Greek word, nosos, which means to know or inner knowing. So it really is about inner wisdom, our own internal inner wisdom. And the Institute of Noetic Sciences was founded in 1973 through a really fascinating story. Edgar Mitchell, who was an engineer and also an astronaut, he was an Apollo 14 astronaut, and he was the sixth person to walk on the moon. He was very linear-minded, brilliant person, and wasn't outwardly very spiritual and didn't have any channeling experiences, if you will. So he was up on the moon. He did his job on the moon, and he was traveling home in his capsule, and the capsule was rotating, and he would see the sun, the earth, the stars, sun, earth, stars, sun, earth, stars. And then he had this incredible transcendent experience where his awareness expanded to encompass all of that. And he felt that he was all of those things and that all of those things were him as well. This lasted for a while. He came back to Earth, and it really was a life-shattering or life-changing experience in that he decided that he had to figure out what that was and what that interconnectedness was. So he founded the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and for the last almost 50 years, it has been exploring this interconnectedness in a variety of different ways, but especially through scientific inquiry and direct experience.
You talk about somebody having a noetic signature. How does that work?
So channeling that I've defined, you know, I described it on this spectrum, and, you know, we have intuition and gut hunches on one side. We might have channeling and mediumship on the other, and precognition, remote viewing, everything else in between. And the way, so we propose at IONS that everyone has the innate ability to access these experiences, that, you know, being able to access information and energy from beyond time and space is an innate capacity that we all have, but that the way it shows up for us is unique. So that's what we're calling the noetic signature. It's your fingerprint. It's like the noetic Myers-Briggs, if you will, this unique expression of your channeling capacity. So we've gone through a number of studies now exploring this concept and have developed something called the Noetic Signature Inventory. It's a 44-item questionnaire that people take, and then they get a report on what their scores are for 12 different characteristics of channeling. Things like intuition, embodied sensations, being able to know things through touch, knowing things through dreams, being able to affect the physical world with your intention, knowing other people's minds, healing, etc. So we have 12 different channeling phenomenon, and then people get a report showing how they score on each of those. And I want to highlight that that's not to say that any of these are better than the others, or that if you score higher on one than the other, that there's something wrong with that. It's just that your specific expression of it is unique to you. So I feel things in my body. I get downloaded information. I am very sensitive to people's emotions. Someone else might see things, you know, might see colors or auras, or they might hear messages like, don't turn left, turn right, you know, and then they avoid an accident or something like that. So the way that these experiences show up for people is quite unique and diverse. So our goal is to roll out this Noetic Signature Inventory to the public in the next couple months. And then we have curriculum either that we build or that we partner with others on each of the 12 different characteristics, so that people can learn how to nurture those aspects of themselves if they choose to.
How would people know that it's not just their imagination? And also, is there another side where people are very happy to accept something when perhaps they should use more critical thinking and be a bit more skeptical?
Great questions. So the imagination piece, can you expand a little bit more on that?
A simple example was I might be sitting watching TV and then something will catch my eye at the other side of the room and I'll look round and there's nothing there. And you think, I'm sure something just moved over there, or there was a little flash of light. But how do I, you know, I think, oh, I just imagined it.
Right. So the questions that we have on our inventory, you know, have a slider. So it's not just like a yes, no. So that question might be, you know, do you see things that your physical eyes might not normally see? And then you rate it on 0 to 100, and there's multiple questions on that. And so, yeah, you can, perhaps it's your imagination, but perhaps it's not. And so that inventory is a subjective tool for people to explore their noetic signature. We also have objective tools. We have a website called GotSci, and on that website, we have a number of different online tasks that you can take to see how well you do on different things. For example, you might see 5 cards, and then you know, you see a picture, and then you have to pick which card has that picture underneath it. Or you might see a blank screen and 5 pictures underneath, and the instruction is pick which picture is going to show up next, and then you pick that picture. So we have a number of these different tasks online that would be objectively testing if you actually have the abilities or not. Now, sitting in your living room watching TV and seeing something in the corner of your eye is hard to test with an online task, right? But we could potentially test clairvoyance and precognition and psychokinesis through some of these online tasks. Our hope is also to take the information from the online tasks and see how they relate to the inventory. So do people's subjective experiences of these match up with how they do on some of these online tasks, which I think would be really fascinating. And then we have a partnership with Columbia University where we're looking at people's structural neuroimaging, so the structure of their brain, and to see how that may line up with people's different subjective experiences. We also are looking at genetics. So, you know, what I talked about, this noetic signature and the uniqueness and diversity of that, but what makes someone be more sight-oriented versus body-oriented? Is there something about that? Why are all, you know, so many people in my family trans-channelers? Is there something about that? And we know that from other studies and anecdotes as well, that these specific abilities sometimes run in families. And so is there some genetic component that we can notice? So we just finished a small pilot study where we found a difference between high-functioning psychics and controls in the DNA. And so we're looking forward to seeing if we can replicate those results. But I think the whole genetics piece is really quite fascinating, too, to see how that lines up with the noetic signature results.
And this idea of critical thinking as well.
Before I jump into that, you mentioned physical mediumship. So, you know, that's a pretty rare, I see physical mediumship as a little different than trans channeling. In physical mediumship, traditionally, you know, people will do a seance. It's in completely dark, completely pitch black. And the belief is that the medium produces something called ectoplasm that can then be manipulated by these non-physical beings. And there have been some incredibly fascinating studies around that. For example, imagine undeveloped film in a locked box, completely locked box, not tampered by anybody. And then, you know, through the process of the mediumistic session, the film actually has images on it. So how do you explain that? It's a completely saran wrapped box of film that's undeveloped in a locked box. Or another fascinating study was, you know, in one of these physical mediumship studies, they had vats of wax, and that there were these waxed hands that were dropping into the people's laps. And this is all done in really impeccable, rigorous methods that, you know, you can't poke holes in it in terms of fraud. So I wanted to just say that about the physical mediumship. Back to your question of discernment, I think this is incredibly important. Some people, you know, receive channeled content and they say, oh, it's channeled, so it must be true, or it's channeled, so I'm going to just listen, I'm just going to follow it off of a cliff because that's what they told me to do. I mean, that's an extreme example, but I do definitely invite people, and I talk about this a lot in the book, about practicing discernment around the information that's coming in, especially around its relevance to you and if there's any actionable piece to it. So I walk people through an exercise to be able to learn how to discern any information they hear from others or any information they're receiving, to practice and strengthen their discernment muscle to see what to actually do with that information, if anything at all.
Yeah, because I had an experience where I saw a medium. I had this, it's actually the third time something like this happened, and each one was related to the previous one, but the last one was really had an impact on me. And it was, I was sitting opposite a medium for about an hour, and she was in a chair opposite, and there was just an empty carpet between us. And I started telling her about how I talked with a medium I was interviewing on the podcast. We'd stopped recording, and I said that I've seen this feather that turned up unexpectedly. And she's saying, some people say this is a sign from an angel, you know, you're seeing a feather. And then the medium said to me, look at the floor. And then between us was a white feather on the carpet. And it hadn't been there that whole hour when she was doing the mediumship reading. And I just don't know where it came from. And so there's this kind of critical thinking of, well, maybe it was stuck to the bottom of my shoe and it just fell off at the right time. But then again, you know, it just did seem to appear out of nowhere. And perhaps maybe it was stuck on my shoe, but then it was the spirits who'd stuck it to my shoe in the first place, getting ready to show it to me later. And yeah. So I found myself just thinking, I just don't know what it was. I can't say that's definitely put there by some spirit, and I can't say it definitely fell off my shoe.
Yeah, and I would then invite you to say, does it really matter? What is the meaning of that feather to you? Does it support you in your life in any way? Does it give you some positive and meaningful message that you can then take away with you?
Yeah, it does, because there was the first time somebody said to me that the angels leave a feather for you, and I saw a feather and I thought it was just a coincidence. The next time I told the medium that I'd seen that feather. And then after I finished the interview, I went into another room and there was a feather on the floor. And that was in my daughter's bedroom. And then I went to see this medium and I said, you know, I found this feather on the floor in my daughter's bedroom. And there's another one with me in the medium. So it was like three times, and they were each sort of ramping up. So every time it happened, it freaked me out a bit more. So it definitely did have an impact on me.
That's beautiful. And, you know, in what I describe in my book on learning to channel, and I've heard this from many other different traditions, is when you set the intention to learn how to channel, and if it fits in your belief system that you have spiritual guides and you aren't hearing answers, you know, you can ask them to give you a sign. You know, give me three signs, three explicitly clear signs that you're connecting with me or that you're communicating with me or whatever. So those three feathers just reminded me of that piece of when people often begin on this path and they start their quests and start setting their intentions around it, and they're having trouble, you know, hearing or receiving, you know, often they'll say, hey, give me a sign, three clear signs. And so there are your feathers. What's fascinating is, I know your listeners can't see this, but the front of the book, The Science of Channeling, has a feather on it. and you know, the publishers created the cover, and they said, hey, this is what the cover's going to be. And I didn't work with them, you know, it wasn't like a collaborative process. And they're like, what do you think? And it was this feather. And I said, huh, that's interesting. Why is a feather on there? And they gave me this whole like page write up on the incredible transcendent meaning of the feather. So I know this is a little aside, but it's just your story I find quite fascinating.
It's certainly a weird thing. And it's almost like, and not just talking about my experience, but when people have this, it's almost like the spirits are giving you a kick. It's like they're giving you a little slap saying, hey, pay attention. We got some work to do here.
Right. And you can so again, the take home for me is, could this just be a coincidence? Sure, it could. The probability of a feather showing up in your life in that way is probably pretty slim. And so the meaning that you ascribe to it, I think, is the most important.
And I think, like we were saying earlier, that for the person who experiences it, it has a lot of meaning. But if you talk to somebody about it, they might start trying to find reasons why it could have a simple explanation, but right. they don't get the impact because they weren't there, they didn't experience it. And right. so do you think that people are having these experiences all around us all the time, but they're too afraid to talk about it?
Yes, I know that that's true, actually. You know, when I first started the IONS Channeling Research Program and started giving presentations about the results that we were finding from our studies, I would always have people come up to me, if it was in person or through email, saying, hey, thank you so much. I've had this experience. I can't talk to anyone about it. They're going to think I'm crazy. What should I do? Please hear my story. I want to share my story with you because I know you're into this and you aren't going to laugh at me. Over and over and over again. And I'm not alone. Like, all my colleagues in these fields get these emails all the time. People feeling so isolated, feeling so afraid in their experience, afraid to share with others about their experiences. And that was, you know, my major motivation, I think, for writing the book, is so that all of these people don't have to feel afraid anymore. It's like, look, this is so common. There's so much research that's already been done on this. Yes, we have a lot more to learn, and yet it's much stronger foundation of research than anyone possibly knows. Like, I didn't know that. I was so completely isolated in my familial background. When I first started at IONS, I had no clue that parapsychology even existed. I had no clue that this stuff had been studied for almost 150 years. Unbelievable. Blew me away. And I started getting into the literature. I'm like, this is real. Like, people have actually been doing incredibly rigorous work on this for a really long time. So I feel like everyone should know that. I want to scream that from the mountaintops. Number one, it's so incredibly common. And two, there's a bunch of science on this that people aren't even aware of.
And there are people in positions of power, I suppose, who also very materialistic and kind of closed down. And you say in your book how you were told once that your study should not have been done because it was impossible.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. The review, that it was the editor of a journal where we submitted a paper on the future of meditation. And it was really a mild paper. It basically surveyed meditators, asking them about a variety of different experiences that they may have had during meditation. And the editor basically said, the question you're asking, you know, the fact that you're asking these things, these phenomena are impossible. So you asking if these people had those experiences is unscientific. It's like asking if pigs can fly. Your research question is ridiculous. And not only am I rejecting this paper, but I'm also going to put energy into making sure that this type of research never gets published anywhere. I mean, it was like this vehemently angry, crazy rejection.
And didn't they say they try and stop any public grant money being spent on this research?
Yeah. And so, you know, this goes back to paradigms and worldviews and being in a very deep transitional place between a materialistic paradigm and a post-materialistic paradigm. Because it's true, if you're incredibly entrenched in a materialistic worldview, these phenomena are impossible, and it would be ridiculous to ask those questions. But we're learning more and more that the materialistic paradigm does not explain our world. It only explains one, you know, not one, but some aspects of it, and that there's more phenomenon that are outside of this materialistic paradigm that maybe a post-materialistic worldview explain more easily. And in that, our consciousness is non-local. Our consciousness isn't limited to our physical brain or bodies. And you know, these meditators, some said that they could connect to their teacher from afar, or that during deep, long, extended periods, they had connection with non-physical beings, etc. So that's quite fascinating.
Yeah, and the studies are being done. It's not like that guy succeeded and stopped any of kind of experimentation, because you talk about forced choice tasks and belief affecting performance and trying to influence dice and random number generators, and studies showing that someone can tell when they're being stared at.
That's right. All of those studies are, you know, have a number of different labs and separate studies replicating the findings for each one of those. So I want to talk about the funding for a minute, and then I can talk a little bit more about those studies. So when you compare the funding for parapsychology for other research domains, it's minuscule. So the studies are happening, but the funding to support it is incredibly small. And so I think one benefit that I hope will unfold from this work being more in the mainstream and more accepted is that more research funding will go towards it, because while there is a lot of work that has been done, there's so much that we still don't know. And it would be wonderful to be able to answer a lot of those research questions with increased funding. So those specific experiments you talked about are so fun and just really inspire the imagination. The remote steering one is was kind of championed by Rupert Sheldrake. And so he was inspired by this experience that so many of us have had of, you know, let's say you're sitting in a cafe, you're drinking your cappuccino, and then all of a sudden you turn around and someone's looking at you and you're like, oh, this person's looking at me. And, you know, this whole remote being able to sense when someone's staring at you. So he did some various surveys out in the world and then a number of experiments in the laboratory. Imagine two people. One person is in a different room and they have a closed circuit TV, video camera focused on them. And then someone's in a completely other room and they stare at the person through the TV. So the staree, if you will, can tell when they're being stared at, even through the TV, even from a distance. So those studies are quite incredible. There was even a remote facilitation study done where like people were taking tests and people were directing their intention at them to do better on the test. And then they did better on the test, which is also quite interesting. You mentioned the dice tasks. Those are basically around intention affecting the physical world or psychokinesis. And there's two types of psychokinesis. There's macro, which is things we can see with our eyes, you know, like the spoon bending or, you know, levitating an object or something like that. There haven't been a lot of studies on macro psychokinesis, but there have been a ton of studies on micro psychokinesis. And that's intention affecting the physical in probabilistic systems that we can then see through statistics. So it started with dice rolling. So being able to influence the number, you know, the die face that shows up first. And those dice studies, there were, I don't know, hundreds, thousands of trials of these dice studies and a meta-analysis done to show significant findings above chance that when people focus their intention to have a certain face of the die show up, that it does more than chance. It's a small effect, but it's a replicable, clear effect. From dice, people moved into radioactive isotopes because you don't know when the when it's going to be emitted. So it's this random process. So there are a number of studies with people directing their intention to these radioactive objects to see if the isotope, when the isotopes, if they could be influenced by the intention. That quickly moved to random number generators because I don't think people really wanted to work with radioactive objects.
Yeah, yeah.
So the random number generators spit out zeros and ones in a random way. And there were a number of different studies with people directing their intention towards the devices to see if they could move it more towards ones or more towards zeros. That's, you know, next generation is what we're using at our lab at IONS, our quantum noise generators. So instead of having random zeros and ones, it's just random noise. And we're seeing how that noise, that randomness of that noise shifts in various experiments, like energy healing experiments, trans channeling, directly focusing our intention on it, on and on. We have many different studies looking at that. So those three examples that you gave, oh yeah, the force choice. The force choice is this card test that I described to you as an example. You get five pictures that are showing and you're forced to choose one of them to see if it matches what's going to happen next. There's been meta-analyses on that, again, showing a clear, significant effect beyond chance. Opposite to free choice is something called, forced choice is free choice. So that's when you might see a gray square and the investigator asks you, hey, describe the picture that's going to show up next. And then the person would maybe write out what they think would appear. And that's a free choice because the participant isn't being forced to pick one of five answers. So all of those paradigms have multiple studies showing significant findings above chance. And you can learn a lot more about that, about those studies in my book. We have all of our publications on our website that go into the methods in great detail, but the studies are there. It's quite fascinating.
Fantastic. And your book is The Science of Channeling, which is on Amazon, isn't it? And
it is.
Can people get it other places?
Yes. Most of your big booksellers will have it in stock for you. Barnes & Noble, bookstore.com.
Well, that's fantastic. Thanks for being a guest on the podcast. It's been really great talking to you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
And that was an interview with Helen A. Warbear about her book, The Science of Channeling, Why You Should Trust Your Intuition and Embrace the Force That Connects Us All. A great way to support the podcast is to sign up on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/pastlivespodcast or click on the button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. This is the free 1 hour version of the episode. The extended episode is 1 hour 20 minutes. If you join the $2 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. If you join the $5 a month tier, you will have access to an extended episode every week and the back catalogue of extended episodes. Also, if you're a patron, you get a 25% discount when you book a past life regression session with me. There is a Past Lives Podcast Facebook group, and if you'd like to join, you'd be very welcome. And if you enjoy the podcast, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.